Welcome to the View My Seats podcast with John Lord, a series of conversations on sports and culture with various fans, friends, and media personalities. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or by visiting viewmyseats.com. Thanks for listening. Billy Beane, Major League Baseball's Ambassador for Inclusion. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
You've been Major League Baseball's Ambassador for Inclusion for almost a year now. And my first question is how the job's going so far?
Well, it's expanding rapidly. I think that is one of the great surprises that we have seen at the Office of the Commissioner when that conversation started. It was, you know, for lack of a better metaphor, it was out of left field. I did not expect, I wasn't pursuing a job in baseball. I remained in love with the sport and, you know, sad that I left under the, you know, the for the reasons I did. But I think the body of work that I had outside of baseball is what interested the guys in the labor relations department who made it happen. And the first initial conversation, I didn't know what they just wanted my opinion on things and kind of the state, you know, the bridge between sports and the whole sexual orientation, non-discrimination, anti-harassment, broadening awareness, how do we create leaders? And, you know, once you get me plugged in, I can talk forever. I've been out there for a while. And then, you know, like I said, I went back home in L.A., and a couple days later they called and they asked me if I would consider working with them. But even that description was a little vague because we weren't sure to what degree it would be embraced, I guess, because it is a new conversation and it was ahead of all the other sports for sure. And it just seems from the beginning, at the onset, I started as a consultant, and we agreed that I would do a couple of important, you know, winter meetings and rookie development camp events. One of my supervisors, Wendy Lewis, who runs the Diversity and Strategic Alliance Division, she had an amazing idea that she just realized that nobody really knew about me or my story. It's easy to, you know, for some people to assume that, much like you would assume that they all understand a workplace code of conduct, you know, that players, but in that same light, I learned she had me introduce myself basically to the Office of the Commissioner, MLB Network, MLB.com, and from those three moments where I, you know, showed a video that I had shown at times as a keynote speaker around the country, and then just talked and introduced myself, then the momentum started to begin. And then where everything changed, I believe, is Dan Halem, who is my boss. He is the lead counsel for all legal affairs and labor relations in MLB, and he is just been incredibly supportive and visionary, and he told me, he directed me that I would be leaving the next day to go speak in the last appointment slot to general managers in November, and so I jumped on a plane and I went out to Phoenix, and it's not easy to get all of those gentlemen in one place, and based on that introduction, I got about 20 minutes. 16 separate teams invited me to come to see their players in spring training. And so that is really where my job has, we've seen it, the interest just expand quickly. The closer I got to the players, I guess my ability to be relatable to them and explain the opportunity, the responsibility that goes with wearing a uniform, the wonderful generosity of the message of acceptance and how it is a part of all diversity awareness and our workplace code of conduct, which is mandated by the league. And it's not mandated that I come and speak to these teams, but in every instance so far, if I've spoken to the players, then the relationship is there's been a request for me to come speak to the front office. And so, and then from there, we start talking about social or community outreach. And I'm proud of the way it's expanded, and I feel like I had a good idea of the best way, and that was just to keep my personality and not try to be somebody I'm not, and I'm not preaching to them. I'm not demanding anything that they change the way they feel or think. I'm just trying to offer them to make a consideration for a significant part of our fan base and our society, and the good things that can come from, you know, the platform that every baseball player gets when they put on a baseball uniform.
Would the reception have been different if there was somebody, there was an ambassador for inclusion back when you played in the late 80s, early 90s, than the reception you received today?
Would the reception from the players?
Yeah, from the players, yeah.
I think there is a large amount of mutual respect between the office of the commissioner himself, and the Players Association, which I was a part of for 10 years. But it's a different time now. So I think the answer has to be yes. I don't know, you know, what I do like and very proud of about baseball is that we are in front of the conversation, and we're not doing a spin to try to fix something that happened as an oversight, and we are presenting the players with information, and ultimately they have to decide what they stand for, and I'm comfortable with that. You know, everybody's not going to always be 100% on board with any kind of initiative, but I can tell you myself, and I probably wouldn't have been comfortable with someone talking to us about LGBT issues in the 80s, and I was gay. You know, I was closeted. I had not really ever had an experience, and I think that made me probably more hesitant to even consider, embrace, or talk about the subject. But, you know, I got married very, very young. It wasn't until 5 years into my marriage that I had my first experience. And I think that, you know, that's part of the way that I am respectful of everybody's progress or the pace at which they are able to accept something new or different to their life. And I'm a perfect example of that. And I grew up in sports. I was good at sports. I never had any kind of image that ever crossed my life that of a gay man in sports, or that was openly gay, for sure. I'm sure there was gay men and women, but, and so I just thought, well, that can't be me. And, you know, I mean, we're all different, but I am fiercely protective of that journey for all people. And, you know, some kids realize that who and what they are at a very young age. You know, we're seeing more and more and more images of that. And I think part of it is that the access to information, people identify and understand what they're seeing on a computer screen. I don't know how old you are, but I did not have that opportunity as a grown young man. And it was a different time and place. You had to go talk to a stranger or somebody, or have the courage to go somewhere that nobody would want to talk about. And so, you know, for me, I look at the young kids who are identifying and putting themselves at times in harm's way. You know, it creates a difficult environment for their family. Some parents are not accepting. They're the heroes where they're just courageous enough to be who and what they are, which makes them susceptible to bullying and being made fun of, being, you know, put on the margin. And I think that what the reminder of that for me, it just makes me so firm in my goal to make the culture around baseball an accepting one before we put all of the onus on one player's shoulders and let them be the ambassador for everyone's progress while they're trying to play. You saw how with Michael Sam, I think the weight of it started to take an effect upon him. And, you know, I hope he's comfortable with his decision, and I hope he plays in the NFL very, very much. But you can see now that when things did not go exactly the way that the press expected them, it seemed to be a situation where he was the center of a conversation that had nothing to do with his football ability. And that scares me for players. I think players that might be playing with the same secret in whatever sport may have taken a step backwards in their, you know, if they felt that they were on the verge of being ready to come forward. And who could blame them? I have a big job to do, and I feel very responsible for their success. I want all the players to have healthier coming out, you know, stories or experiences, much like we're seeing in college campuses or in the workplace, corporate America. There's a lot of imagery to support a player doing so, but still, and I can tell you from my first experience of walking into a clubhouse as the only openly gay man 16 different times this spring with different teams, it's still not an easy thing to do. And it was a test for me. The old Billy Beane baseball player personality was there, and I wanted those guys who are my peers. They're younger, of course, but I wanted them to look at me as a baseball player because I was. And most of the guys I talked to, I probably played longer in the big league than they have. You know, it's just, but the nature of what happens when you come out is the first, you know, adjective instead of my name is gay. And, I hope someday that is just an anecdote for everyone, you know, just to be absolutely judged upon, you know, the talent that you're bringing to whatever environment you are and what goal you're trying to accomplish, whether you want to be a baseball player or, a basketball player or president of the United States or own a baseball team or whatever.
And as a society, we've come so far as in regards to how accepting we are now. But as you've alluded to it, the clubhouse is still a different place. What types of things do you think would need to change in baseball and other sports for the professional clubhouse to be the type of place where an openly gay athlete can coexist?
Well, I think all those things are changing. I just think a player, it's very healthy for him to see that his organization or his sport is providing constant, consistent images of support for all people of diversity. You know, you can imagine, you know, to use a very vivid example of what it must have been like for Jackie Robinson to have players turning their back on him because they did not support the idea of an African American playing on the same field. And it was well proven that he belonged out there and was better than 99% of all players at that time, even being a Hall of Famer. So I just think that when you need to hear, this is what I mean about, you know, our society wants an image, an answer. You know, I hear all the time when I first got the job, before we saw the Michael Sam situation play out and when Jason Collins was still playing out the partial part of the season that he signed a contract after the trading deadline with the Brooklyn Nets. Look at basketball, look at football. You know, why isn't there something in baseball? But now you look up now, there's no basketball player, there's no football player, there's never been a hockey player, and there's no baseball player, past or present, you know, in hockey, which is incredible as well. And that tells you what, there's your answer. How's the environment? The players themselves are telling you, because we know if you accumulate number of all those athletes put together, that there has to be a handful of players who are playing with the same reality that I live with my life every day. So it just means to me that there's a lot of work to do, and baseball, I can tell you, I haven't slept in the same place once in the last 10 months. I've been on the road so much. Baseball is doing a lot to lead this conversation, and I feel a tremendous responsibility to introduce that message the right way so I can build a team of people that help this conversation. You know, and it's not just one person. It's a group where we have someone that is building that argument for each team. And that's not going to happen overnight. I know that the Commissioner Manfred, Dan Halem, Wendy Lewis, all the people that are instrumental in support for my job, that they created it, we are going to get there. And it's just a matter of being diligent, and I can't let the days where I'm not feeling the messages fully embraced, I can't let that detract from me, because there's been days where I see teams, you know, some teams have just been so supportive and, you know, basically demanding me to come back. It's just not even in any real capacity, much as just to be there and talk baseball. I'm kind of an operations guy. I would have done that had I stayed in baseball. If you look back in all the press clippings as a player, I was groomed in that way, you know, that I expected to stay in baseball forever, because that's what I love the most. And so it's easy to initiate the conversations, especially guys that are from the same generation of as me. We talk about, at the rookie development camp, for example, the Major League Baseball Players Association brought probably 20 former players that are there to be mentors to the current young players. And I probably played with 90% of them. And the dialogue, played against them. You know what I mean? We had all these stories to share, and we were there for the good of baseball. And there was just such great growth, and people are starting to see that this conversation does not have to be so stressful. You know, it can be a way to open baseball up and make it a little bit better outside the lines.
You mentioned Michael Sam in football and Jason Collins in basketball, two athletes that came out of the closet while they were still players, and they weren't star players by any stretch, by any means. Do you think that what it's really going to take to bring about change, to lead to more people feeling comfortable to come out while they're still playing, it's going to take a superstar athlete in their sport to come out while they're still playing? Do you think that's going to be what brings about the most change as far as, you know, seeing these athletes coming out while they're still playing? Because society is clearly on the side of progress and acceptance, and, you know, we are just, you know, waiting for the moment where, you know, sports embraces all members of the community equally. It's something that we as a community, as a progressive community, are looking for, but the athletes, I wonder what they're waiting for. Is the star player the thing that could perhaps push us ahead here?
Well, I think it would help. I don't know if it's going to take that to make it happen. I mean, Jason Collins was the perfect example. He had a 12-year career, a body of work. He was a team player. He's a college graduate from Stanford. He's extremely intelligent. He played on some very good teams. You know, never had a bad day with any of his teammates. And so for Jason Kidd and the Brooklyn Nets, it didn't seem a risk. And he's also 7 feet tall. And he's a good basketball player.
Right.
And he played his role as a defensive player. And so there was no argument that anyone could make that, oh, he doesn't belong in the league because he's gay, because he just proved the previous 12 years. But the irony was that no team offered him a deal after he came out. And he did not play until the third or fourth month of the season. I went to the first game. I was at the Staples Center when I've been saying that for 15 years, I will be the first person, I will be at that game with the first person who comes out in the four major sports. And I did it, and it was, had my own little emotional moment, and I was so proud of him, and him and I have become incredibly close friends. And, the fact is there's never been an openly gay football player play it down in the NFL. Michael Sam has not done that yet. My friend Sarah Tuolo played 9 years. Dave Cope, there's been, I think, Roy Simmons or a few other players that have admitted to it over the years. But Jason is really the shining example of somebody who was in a good spot, and it showed because of his body of work. He did he saw, and he's been incredibly gracious, saying that he learned a lot from people like myself, or Martina Navratilova, or Dave Cote, and he wanted to do it. He felt compelled, and it was, I think he was at a point in his life where it just became a matter of almost life or death for him, because he had suppressed himself so deeply for so many years. Even his own twin brother didn't know until about, I think, 7 or 8 months before he announced it. I mean, that's amazing, you know, for two young men who went to college together, grew up, spent every single day of their life. That's what it feels like when you're an athlete and you don't want to change the way people look at you. So I think that that would definitely help. And we, as a sport, will be supportive of anybody who is ready to do that. My more concern is that we have so many young kids who are fully secure in their sexual orientation, that are 15 and 16 and 17. And I want those kids, that generation, to feel safe and secure to be their best self and sign a professional contract and be treated equally as they move up the minor leagues and come to the big leagues. So sure, you know, that a superstar player, that paves the road for everybody. But if we sit around and wait for that, I think it's incredibly offensive to all the stakeholders, all the current employees in baseball that work in there who have been in the closet. Some have stepped out of the closet since I took office, and I was talking to some of them before they made that decision, and they felt empowered by the Commissioner Seelig introducing me at the All-Star Game last year. It's just a simple message goes so far, but we can't just sit back and wait for that. You have to be out there. And part of me going to see these teams, and they, you know, the general managers, you know, the commissioner's office is not telling teams that they have to do this. And I don't want it to be that way. I want the people to be ready and feel confidence in me that I will be respectful of their organization, their community, the message. I stand by my body of work and the type of life I've carried out. And I struggled for a long time with myself because I just didn't think there was a place for someone like me. And as opposed, I had never even had a conversation with my own parents. And it was a tremendous regret. Now I see that I was a better baseball player than I forgot, because I was mired in a hole of sadness and grief and self-destructive behavior with, you know, I didn't like myself very much. I was full of being in shame, and I'm grateful to the team community that I got to know after I stopped playing baseball. I wish I had known some of these people that changed my life. You know, these people are these pioneers who are have dedicated themselves, and it's not always been a popular thing to do. And they got me right where I needed to be, and it was a life changing moment, and I'm forever grateful. And it inspires me to be the guy that can try to help make that impact on others. Because sometimes they don't always get to tell you thank you. You know, that's another thing. Not everybody's going to reach out and make a comment on Facebook or send you a tweet or a letter. I've gotten tons and tons of those things, but there's a lot of people out there I've met in passing. I've met people in ballparks that recognize me, and they come up and tap me on the shoulder, and they just want to give me a hug, and they just say, thank you. You know, you helped me 8 years ago when I was in a really bad place. And it's just like, you think, what a gift to be able to forgive yourself for, you know, a mistake that, you know, hurt me individually and personally, but the opportunity that whatever my life experience, however that put me here, I feel just a tremendous responsibility to try to reach out to as many people as possible. I really do.
It's really, Billy, it's really interesting to hear you say that your baseball career was hindered not by the fact that you were gay, but by the fact that you were just consumed with your sexuality and fears about, you know, coming out and your sexuality. Do you think you would have had a better baseball career if you were playing, say, today when society is more tolerant than when you were a player?
Yes. Yes. The answer to that is capital Y, capital E, capital S. I had no image of... There's a movie that just came out called Out to Win. Malcolm Ingram directed it. It's a documentary. I was fortunate enough to be asked to be in it. But I just saw it the other day, and I could not believe the parallel lives that I was living in with people like Dave Coppé, Martina Navratilova, Billie Jean King, you know, Glenn Burke, Jason, you know, whatever. Just, and then we, none of us knew who to talk to, and the isolation, because we had reached the highest level of our sport, which put us in a very interesting community. And especially for the males, you know, in that movie, there was no one to think that you could talk to, because you don't get to the top of your sport unless that is what defines you. If that's not the thing you love the most, that you dedicated your life to, you sacrificed everything. And I was trying to tell people, I said, you know, most of the players right now that I come into the clubhouse, you know, these guys are 22 years old, 23, some are younger, you know, they have not had a chance to consider social issues yet. They've been playing baseball. You know, they're good at, really good at one thing. And they're trying to catch up the rest of their life stuff. You know, every player will tell you, it's just hilarious stories of how, you know, scattered they were when they got to the big league, because there's so much more responsibility, there's so much more logistics that you have to, you know, take into consideration. And now with these kids, with the social media, and how easy they can turn the whole world around to pay attention to some silly thing they say, I don't know how to do it. And that's why I am seriously protective of all the players, whether they're ready to embrace this or not, to at least let them understand the ramifications of comments that they make about women, about different cultures, different races, you know, gays and lesbians, transgender people, and, you know, just the primary, you know, experience of being around women in the workplace, you know, and understanding how the respectful nature that is mandatory for everyone, you know, and that how easily that privilege of playing can be changed by just a moment of irresponsibility. And so it's not a personal, it's not about them liking me or them feeling sorry for me or me having to explain exactly how hard it was when my partner died or having a game that day or his funeral a few days later or wondering if I was going to be HIV positive for a whole year and you know, just going to the doctor and testing negative every month and feeling like, you know, the world was going to end until they said no, and, you know, losing weight that whole last year and you know, statistically playing incredibly well. It just was weird, you know, the fighting for just to get through it. And I think once the season ended, that's why everything emotionally unraveled for me, having to be somewhere every single day, having a game every day. It helped me with my grief, but it didn't allow me to heal. And that's where I got into a very dark place, and I just thought it just probably better if I just stopped playing, because I don't know if my heart can take it anymore. And so, you know, it's like I said, it's not about me. A lot of people, I think, initially were wondering, you know, what is his message? Are we going to feel sorry for some guy? You know, it's the big picture. That's where the message is, and one that I never take for granted about, you know, why I'm here. I'm here to communicate what the league is ready to talk about.
How angry do you get when you hear front office types, and it's not just baseball, but other sports? You know, I remember when Michael Sam came out and was going to the you know, through the NFL draft and things like that. And people talked about how, you know, there were teams that were scared of drafting Michael Sam, not because of his NFL talent, but because of that he would be a distraction. And these are some of the same general managers and teams that are, you know, constantly signing, you know, serial abusers to their team, you know, domestic abusers, really violent criminals with a very sordid, checkered past. And I mean, how upset does it make you when there are those types on rosters and people throw out the idea of a gay player being a distraction?
Well, I think it shows you how baseball is in front of this conversation. I think more so. Certainly, what makes me angry is people equate being gay to domestic violence. That's what makes me angry.
I hope I didn't do that.
But it's easy for people to do that, you know, in a way. And that just shows you the amount of work that needs to be done, you know, like when you define distraction or what. It's not, I can tell you this, if a player decides to come out, it's not the player that people are worried about them changing, it's the people around that player. And so that's how we need to create a dialogue in the environment that allows these players a minute to process this, and it's not just thrust upon them. That's why I defended Daniel Murphy of the Mets when, you know, after two completely uneventful, positive, you know, great days with the Mets in spring training, I was on BP, shagging fly balls, you know, catching his fly balls and his, you know, reporter runs up and asks him in his locker room, in his environment, something that he's never had to answer before. And, you know, he basically was asked to define his life versus mine, and, you know, he had never had an opportunity to really have a conversation with someone like me. I think he's a very principled man, and I was fiercely protective of his, you know, he's a born-again Christian, and he's devout to his family. I think he stands up for many things. You know, he skipped home opening day last year because he wanted to be there for the birth of his child. That was controversial for some. You know, he makes $9 million a year. Some people think, you know, where's your responsibility? But the fact of the matter is that it was at least an honest conversation, and it wasn't a checklisted thing. And I think the end result was a very positive reaction from me. It allowed the rest of the league to see that for us to have actual growth and change, there has to be a conversation that is real and not just a checklist kind of politically correct response. And, you know, Sandy Alderson has been, you know, just sending me emails daily, you know, come watch the game, and, you know, it's hang out with us. And, you know, we just had a really positive experience. And then now we can start to move forward to me introducing myself to their front office. And, you know, it's so, I guess my point is it just takes time. You can't just walk into a room and try to change the landscape and expect everybody to say yes, sir. They've got, you know, hundreds of years of homophobia embraced in clubhouses and sports, and it's going to take a little time to, like I said, put that conversation in front of someone and then let them make up their own mind whether they're willing to buy into. Because it's, you know, I don't think it's an expensive decision to make. I think it's very generous to make a consideration of acceptance for all people. These young athletes are living a dream, and it's just a wonderful world in the big leagues. And I try to get them to see that as a parent, as a teacher, as a role model, as a teammate, you know, a family man, a brother, an uncle, that kind of thing, in a way that, and you can see the people that have had someone from my community intersect into their life. You can just see them nod, like, yep, that's how it works, you know. Just, you know, it's easy to think somebody is, you know, different or not as good as you if you've never crossed paths with them. You know, that's usually why sports has been so great, because it integrates so many people together, and athletes have been great ambassadors for this. So I just think it's a natural extension for us moving forward with this.
You talk about how you spent a lot of time on the speaking circuit, and I'm wondering if you still take the time, with all of your duties for Major League Baseball, I'm wondering if you still take the time to speak to younger athletes, high school students, on sports teams, where really, you know, younger generations of kids are much more open-minded and progressive than older generations. And I wonder if you see that, the younger generations, as the place where real deep-seated, long gestating change can take place. Do you still look to speak to younger groups of kids as far as targeting those sports teams?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, but those kids have not seen an openly gay baseball player play baseball except for me.
Right.
So there's a huge responsibility to be able to show them an image that they can see and relate to. All those people, wherever I'm asked, if it can help someone. I have, you know, that opportunity with baseball, and now with baseball support behind it, it does open other doors, which is great because, you know, baseball is an institution that has great respect and history and a great civil rights history and acknowledgement of that. So, you know, and I agree with you 100%. You know, the sooner that we can get this conversation, I mean, I've spoken at probably, you know, 90% of my appearances over the last 15 years have been at the college level, but the scholastic level, high school, if those environments, I've been closer to Gletson, who is, you know, incredible in that environment about, you know, gay-straight alliances and allyship and that kind of stuff where, you know, people talk about creating friendships and getting the conversation started in a way that's really just about taking care of each other. It's not, you know, how do you feel about X or Y? And so I'm tireless in that regard. I'm not afraid to get out there and it doesn't matter if it's 10 kids or 5 or, you know, 1,000. It's just a matter of, you know, can we get an effective message that's respectful to their age group and how we can do that best.
A few more quick questions for you. You mentioned how you have an intense interest in just the game of baseball from a baseball perspective. How do you think the game is played today? Do you like the way the game is played today? Do you have any criticisms of the way the game is played today? Because I know a lot of fans say that, you know, baseball is too slow, that it's hard to get into baseball, the season's too long, that they don't know a lot of the players anymore. Well, how do you feel about the game of baseball just from a fan perspective?
Well, I'm a purist, and I started playing baseball, you know, a long time ago where we didn't have the attention span that we do now. And so I guess I love the way the game's played. I see, you know, insanely gifted athletes out there. I mean, we seem to be in an amazing era where some really great pitchers are coming up. And I love how the game is going back to speed. I think the sport has done a great job cleaning up the PED era, which was unfortunate. And you know, obviously Commissioner Manfred has, you know, been all about trying to speed up the pace of the games. The bottom line is this, you know, that there's always been a difference between football, basketball, and baseball, and hockey as well. They're faster-paced games. They're on a time clock. I think that the way that we can best cater to the fans, you know, you're seeing much more interactive things going on in the stadiums. The stadiums are beautiful and fan-friendly. The interaction between players. I think, you know, I've been very close with the way we are, you know, trying to build our inner city, reviving baseball in inner city, the RBI program. And you see how excited kids are to play when they're young. You know, it's that middle years, you know, that we all wonder, you know, are kids gonna still want to go outside anymore? and that is a challenge. That is a challenge. And I know our marketing department is, you know, sitting there all day long and trying to come up with ideas to try to make it more palatable, because a four-hour baseball game is too long. It just is. You know, if you're a baseball purist and you see people, you know, the ones that I was reminded of, these extra inning marathons, you have, you know, from a full house down to 200 fans in the seats. You can't explain to anyone why someone would do that unless they love the sport. And I'm hopeful. I'm learning so much right now, and it is different than it was when I left. I have to say, the facilities, the way the athletes take care of themselves, the fundamental nature of the way the players are measured. You know, I think there's a lot of interest with the way that baseball translates online for fantasy leagues. I think you have a lot of interest. But the most important person that we need to keep interested are our kids. So it's certainly on my mind, that's for sure.
Who is the toughest pitcher you ever faced in the major leagues?
That's easy. Randy Johnson, by far and away. And I don't even know if I faced him in a big league game. I faced him at USC. When he was at USC and I was at Loyola,
right.
I faced him. I got hit by a pitch by him there. I got hit by a pitch leading off the game when he was with the Indianapolis Indians and I was with the Toledo Mud Hens at like a 6 o'clock twilight start. Then he struck me out on three pitches that I thought, I mean, it was just survival. And then when the Mariners and the Padres, we shared a Peoria spring training complex, and I had to face him a couple times. In morning games, simulated pitching scrimmages where there's a cage. And, I mean, you just couldn't pick a more impossible situation. So he is always the one that wakes me up in a cold sweat, I think. But I think in games, I think, honestly, Mike Scott was probably of the Astros. That's a long time ago. And I don't know if it's because I just was really in a slump so badly, but I think I got one hit off him in four starts, and he probably struck me out 13 or 14 times. I mean, he just was impossible to hit in that Astrodome. And I used to play, when I was on the Dodgers, the only time I would ever play would be in the Astrodome, pinch hit in the ninth inning in the Dodger Stadium, which was the worst hitting park in the leagues probably then, or in Montreal. It was like, you know, the worst hitter's park ever. And it, you know, when you're a young kid and you're coming off the bench, you're not playing every day, it feels like the pitcher's about 8 feet away from you. And those two guys, I just remember, you know, I was lucky to face Nolan Ryan in a game. And, you know, I've got a hit off a few Hall of Famers and those were amazing memories, but, and those two guys were just, they were scary good.
Who is the best player that you ever played with?
On my team, I have to say Tony Gwynn probably made it look the easiest. In 1987, Alan Trammell was so unbelievably good at every single facet. I was in awe of him. And, you know, I think I watched... It's hard to measure anybody against Barry Bonds when I was with the Padres. He was just so much better than everybody else, I thought, and impossible. We tried everything we could not to pitch to him. He still would demoralize you at least once a game. But on my own team, I got to play with the Dodgers when Earl Hershiser was, you know, in his amazing run, greatness, 88, 89. I was there in 89. But Tony Gwynn just, in 1994, I am sure he would have hit 400. I am so sure. That was the most devastating part of my career when we were locked out or went on strike or whatever people want to call it. I was just hitting my stride in the big leagues with them and having a great year pitching. And he was just, I think he was hitting 395 or 394 or 396 or something. And it just was unbelievable. He lined out half the time. Like, and he got a hit to the half. He was so awesome. He could center a ball like nobody else.
And,
ever, so.
And people might not realize this about Tony Gwynn, but he was a phenomenal athlete. He was a really he played college basketball at San Diego State, right?
He used to play basketball in the off season all the time, and even when he was carrying around extra weight, which he did his whole career. You know, I mean, from 90, it's amazing what he could have done. I look at his son Tony Gwynn Jr. and I think, man, if Tony could have played at that weight with his skill, but he still was fast. He's got a great arm. He still could read the ball. I mean, his instincts were just amazing. But I don't care what anybody said. When that guy was in the batter's box, he could do, at the end of his career, he was just, he had it figured out. And I would have cut off a leg to know half of what he knew up there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To be in that headspace. He never was stressed out. He knew it was just a matter of a pitch or two coming around that was going to make it happen. And most guys are very stressed out there because they don't want to fail. You're living your dream, but it feels like it's going to be pulled out from under you, unless you get that big contract, which, you know, if you look down the roster of most teams, only a couple guys get those. The rest are out there battling for their lives. But it was a privilege to play with him, and it was devastating to go. I was just, you know, last summer, and it was really sad.
Yeah,
he's gone at such a young man. It was sad for me.
Much too soon. And I'm in my mid 30s, and growing up, Tony Gwynn was one of those guys who I watched, and I said, you know, so what if I don't hit home runs? I can do what he does. I can use all fields. You know, I can learn to just be a really good baseball player, and so I idolized him growing up. Last question, Billy, and thank you so much for taking all this time with me today, but how many times a day would you say that you are confused for the general manager of the Oakland A's?
It's getting better. I think in big events, that's when it happens all the time. Big baseball events. But I think I'm starting to make a presence. But for the years and years and years, first of all, before Moneyball came out, he was the one on the other end of this because I had much more notoriety than him outside of baseball, and everybody thought he was a gay general manager there. and then now, I mean, it happens often. I don't know how common it is daily, but it took even a while for people at the Office of the Commissioner at the beginning to be sure that there was another one. And him and I had a really fun visit this spring, Billy being the GM, and he introduced me himself to his players, and we sat in his office and just we were on the same team in 1988 for a minute. I came down from the big leagues a couple times that year, and I think the world of him, and I think that he is obviously he's so instrumental in this sort of sea change in the way people look at baseball and influential in that way. So, it's not a bad guy to be mistaken for. I guess it could be worse.
Yeah. Well, Billy Bean, Major League Baseball's ambassador for inclusion, thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Okay. All right. Thank you.